Force Commander shrugged. Hold our position. Die if we must. Then I will make you an offer, Commander. You must decide if it is a trick or not. Kasumi of the Shinzawe carried an offer from the Light of Heaven to the Midkemian King. It was an offer of peace. The king rejected it, but now there is to be a new king who is willing to make peace. I would ask you to carry word to the Holy City, to the Emperor, that Prince Liam will accept peace. Will you do so? The commander considered. If what you say is true, then I would be a fool to waste my men. What guarantees are you willing to make? I give you my word, as a great one, if that means anything still, that what I say is true. I also promise that your men will be given safe conduct back to the valley, on promise they return to the Empire for a year's time. And I will ride to the valley entrance, to your lines, as hostage. Is that enough? The commander thought it over for a moment as he surveyed his tired, thirsty troops. I will agree, Great One. If it is the Light of Heaven's will that the war end, who am I to prolong it? The Wahoka Toucan have long been known for their bravery. Let it be said they are also worthy of honor for their wisdom. The commander bowed, then turned to his soldiers. Pass the word. We march. Home. Word that the emperor would agree to peace reached the camp 4 days later. Pug had given a message to Watoon to be carried through the rift. It bore the black seal of the assembly, and no one would impede its swift delivery. It had been addressed to Femita, asking him to carry word to the holy city that the new king of the realm would not require retribution, but would accept peace. Liam had shown visible emotion when Pug had read the message. The emperor himself would come through the rift in a month's time and would sign formal treaties with the kingdom. Pug had felt close to tears when he read the news, which soon spread through the camp that the war was over. A great cheering could be heard. Pug and Colgan sat in the older magician's tent. For the first time in years, they had been feeling something like their old relationship. Pug was finishing up a long explanation of the Surani system of instructing novices. Pug, said Colgan, around a long pull on his pipe. It seems that now the war is over, we can return to the business of magicians. Only now it is you who are master, and I who would be student. There is much we may learn from each other, Colgan. But I fear old habits die hard. I don't think I could ever get used to the idea of your being a student. And there are many things you are capable of that I still cannot do. Colgan seemed surprised. Really? I would have thought my simple arts beneath your greatness. Pug felt the old embarrassment from when he had been Colgan's student. You make sport of me yet? Colgan laughed. Only a little, boy. And you are still a boy to one of my advancing years. It is not easy for me to see an indifferent apprentice become the most powerful magician of another world. Indifferent was the proper word for it. At first, I only wanted to be a soldier. I think you knew that. Then, when I had finally decided to devote myself to study, the invasion began. Pug smiled. I think you felt sorry for me that day when I stood alone before the Duke's court, the only boy not called. That is partly true, though I was the first to sense the power in you. And the judgment was borne out, no matter the amazing events required to bring your ability to fruition. Pug sighed. Well, the assembly is nothing if not complete in its training. Once the power is detected, there are but two options, success or death. With all other thoughts banished, there is little to concern the student but the study of magic. Without that, I doubt I would ever have amounted to much. Colgan said, I think not. Had the Surani never come, there would still have been a path to greatness for you to follow. They sat and talked, and were comforted by each other's presence. After a while, they lit fires, for darkness was falling. Katala came to the tent to see if her husband was to join her and the boy at the celebration feast being given by King Liam. She looked inside and saw the two of them lost in conversation. She backed out and, with a faint smile on her lips, returned to her son. Chapter 13. Deceptions. Thomas awoke with a start. In the pre-dawn darkness, something strange called to him. He sat up, every sense extended, trying to recapture what had awakened him. Aglaranus stirred next to him. Since his return from the confrontation with Martin over the Serrani prisoners, he had been free of the alien dreams and the blind rages. He was no longer the boy from Cridy or the ancient dragon lord, but a new being possessing qualities of both. She came awake and slowly reached out to touch his shoulder. The muscles were relaxed, free of the tension that marked his grappling with an ancient dream. She breathed a long sigh, then said, Thomas, what is it? He reached up to cover her hand with his own. I don't know. Something odd occurred a moment ago. He sat with his head slightly turned, as if listening to something distant. A change. A shift in the pattern of things, perhaps. The Elf Queen said nothing. Since becoming his lover, she had grown used to his uncanny ability to sense events elsewhere, an ability unmatched by even the most gifted of the ancient spellweavers. A remnant of his Vel'Huru heritage, this awareness had come fully into bloom since he recovered his humanity. She thought it strange, yet reassuring, that his Vel'Huru powers had become more pronounced and acute only since regaining his humanity. It was as if some force had conspired to keep them blunted until he possessed the wisdom to use them. Thomas stopped listening. It is something to the east. A mixture of rejoicing and a great sadness. His voice sounded thick with emotion. An age is dying. He rolled off the sleeping pallet and stood, powerful muscles revealed to Aglarana's elven eyes in the dim light. He stood at the door of their sleeping chamber, looking out over Elvanda, listening to the sounds of the night. Everything appeared calm. The scent of the forest, thick, sweet, and heady, was overlaid with the faint hints of aromas from last night's supper and the smell of bread fresh from the oven for this morning's meal. Night birds sang, while day birds began their pre-dawn warbling, and the sun prepared to rise in the east. The touch of cool air upon his naked skin was a caress to Thomas, and he felt more complete and at peace than he had ever been in his young life. Aglarana's arms went around his waist, and he felt her press tight against him. He could feel the beat of her heart as she held him close. My lord, my love, she said, return to our bed. He turned within the circle of her arms and felt the warmth of her body against his. There is something. He gripped her close, but gently. There is a feeling of hope. She could feel his heat as his desire answered hers. Hope. Would that it is true. He looked down at her face, his senses as acute in the gloom as hers, drinking in the sight of her. Never lose hope, my queen. He kissed her deeply, and whatever awakened him was quickly forgotten. Liam sat quietly in his tent. He was composing the message he would send to Cridy when a guard entered and announced the arrival of Pug and Colgan. Liam rose and greeted them, and when the guards left, indicated they should sit. "I am sorely in need of your wisdom." He sat back and waved at the parchments before him. "If Arutha is to reach us in time for the peace conference, these must leave today. But I have never been much for letters, and I also confess to great difficulty in sharing the events of the last week." Colgan said, "May I?" pointing to the letter. Liam waved consent, and the magician picked up the parchment and began to read. "To my beloved brother and sister, it is with the deepest sorrow I must tell you of our father's death. He was injured mortally in the great Tsurani offensive, leading a counterattack to rescue surrounded soldiers, mainly Hadati hillmen, auxiliaries to the garrison of Yabon. The Hadati sing his name and make sagas in his honor, such was his bravery. He passed thinking of his children, and his love for us all was undiminished. The king has also passed, and it has fallen to me to lead our armies. Arutha, I would have you here, for we now are at the war's end. The emperor is willing to make peace. We shall meet in the north valley of the Grey Towers in 29 days' time at noon. Carleen, I would have you take ship to Krondor with Anita, for there is much to be done there, and Princess Alicia will have need of her daughter. I will join you with Arutha once peace has been made. With love and sharing in your sorrow, I am your most loving brother, Liam." Colgan was quiet for a moment, and Liam said, "I thought you might be able to add something or other, to lend elegance to it." Colgan said, "I think you announced your father's passing with simplicity and gentleness. It is a fine message." Liam shifted uncomfortably in his chair. "There is so much yet to write. I have said nothing about Martin." Colgan took up a quill. "I will copy this again, for your pen is a bit strangled, Liam." With a warm smile, he added, "You were always one to prefer the sword to the quill. I'll add some instructions to the end, asking that Martin go to Krondor with your sister. Godan and Fannin should also make the journey, and an honor company of the castle garrison. It will make it seem you mean to honor those who served so well in Cridy. Then you will have ample time to decide how to tell Martin what you must." Pug shook his head sadly. "I only wish you could add Roland's name to that list." Since coming to the camp, he had learned of the Squire of Tulan's death. Colgan had told him of what he knew of events in Cridy and elsewhere concerning his old friends over the last few years. Liam said, "Curse me for a fool. Carleen has no idea you are back, Pug. You must add that, Colgan." Pug said, "I hope it will not come as too much of a shock." Colgan chuckled. "Not so much of a shock as discovering you've a wife and child." Memories of his boyhood and his tempestuous relationship with the princess returned, and Pug said, "I hope also she has outgrown some of the notions she held 9 years ago." Liam laughed for the first time since his father's death, genuinely entertained by Pug's discomfort. "Rest assured, Pug. I've had many long communications with my brother and sister over the years, and I judge Carleen a greatly changed young woman from the girl you once knew. She was 15 years old when last you saw her. Think of your own changes in the last 9 years." Pug nodded. Colgan finished his copy work and handed the document to Liam. He read it and said, "Thank you, Colgan. You've added just the right note of gentleness." The tent flap opened, and Brokaw entered, his old, lined face animated with glee. "Bas Tyra's fled!"
"How?"
asked Liam. "Our soldiers must still be a week from Krondor, maybe more." The old Duke sat heavily in a chair.
"We found a hidden cage of messenger pigeons belonging to the late Richard of Salador. One of his men sent word to Guy of Roderick's death, and your being named heir. We've questioned the fellow, a valet of Richard's. He's admitted to being one of Bas Tyra's spies in Richard's court. Guy's fled the city, knowing one of your first acts as king will be to have him hung. My guess is he will make straight for Rilannon."
"I would have thought that would be the last place on Mid-Kemia he would wish to be," remarked Colgan.
"Black Guy is no man's fool, whatever else may be said of him. He'll be underground, no doubt, but you'll see his handiwork again before we are through. Until the crown is resting upon Liam's head, Guy is still a power in the kingdom."
Liam looked troubled at the last remark, thinking of his father's dying declaration. Since Brokaw's admonition to say nothing of Martin, everyone had spoken only of Liam's coronation, nothing of Martin's possible claim to the crown. Liam let these disturbing thoughts pass by as Brokaw continued speaking.
"Still, with Bas Tyra on the sly, most of our troubles are now behind. And with the war near an end, we can get back to the business of rebuilding the kingdom. And I, for one, am glad. I am getting too old for much more of this nonsense of war and politics. I only regret I am without a son, so I could announce in his favour and retire."
Liam studied Brokaw with affectionate disbelief.
"You'll never bow down gracefully, old war dog. You'll go to your deathbed scratching and clawing every inch of the way. And that day is years off."
"Who's talking of dying?"
snorted Brokaw. "I mean to hunt my hounds and fly my falcons and do some fishing as well. Who knows? I may find some comely wench hearty enough to keep up with me. Say, about 17 or 18 years of age, and remarry and father a son yet. If that young fool Vandross ever gathers his wits about him and marries my Felina, you just see how fast he'll become Duke of Yabon when I retire. Why she still waits for him is anybody's guess."
He heaved himself up from his chair.
"I am for a hot bath and some sleep before supper. By your leave?"
Liam motioned he might leave and, when he was gone, said, "I will never get used to this business of people needing my permission to come and go." Pug and Colgan rose from their chairs. Colgan said,
"You had better, for everyone will ask it of you from now on. With your permission?"
Feigning disgust, Liam motioned they might go. The council sat in assembly as Aglarana took her place upon the throne. Besides the normal council, Martin Longbow was present, standing beside Thomas. When all were in place, Aglarana said,
"You have asked for counsel, T'thar. Now tell us what cause you bring before us."
T'thar bowed slightly to the queen.
"We of the council felt it time for an understanding."
"Of what, T'thar?"
asked the elf queen.
T'thar said, "We have laboured long to bring a peaceful, secure ending to this business of Thomas. It is known by all here that our arts were turned to calming the rage within, softening the might of the Valhorru, so the young man who was transformed would not be overwhelmed in the course of time."
He paused, and Martin leaned close to Thomas.
Trouble.
Thomas startled him with a slight smile and a wink. Once more, Martin was reassured that the mirthful boy he had known in Crydee was as much present in this young man as the Dragon Lord.
Everything will be fine, said Thomas in a whisper.
We have, said T'Thar, come to judge this business done, for Thomas is no longer to be feared as an old one.
Aglarana said,
That is happy news indeed, but is this then cause for a council?
No, lady. Something else must also be laid to rest, for while we no longer fear Thomas, still we will not place ourselves under his rule.
Aglarana stood, outrage clear upon her face.
Who dares to presume this? Has there been a single word from any to suggest that Thomas seeks to rule?
T'Thar stood firm before his queen's displeasure. My lady, you see with a lover's eyes. Before she could answer, he held up his hand.
Speak not sharp words with me, daughter of my oldest friend. I make no accusations. That he shares your bed is no one's concern save yourself. We begrudge you nothing. But he now has the means of a claim, and we would have the matter settled now.
Aglarana paled, and Thomas stepped forward.
What means?
He said, his voice commanding. T'Thar looked slightly surprised.
She carries your child. Did you not know?
Thomas was bereft of words. Conflicting feelings ran through him. A child. Yet he had not been told. He looked at T'Thar.
How do you know?
T'Thar smiled, and there was no mockery in it.
I am old, Thomas. I can see the signs.
Thomas looked to Aglarana.
It is true?
She nodded.
I would not tell you until it was no longer possible to hide the truth.
He felt a stab of uncertainty.
Why? To spare you any worry. Until the war is through, you must put your mind to nothing else. I would not burden you with other thoughts.
Thomas stood quietly for a moment, then threw back his head and laughed, a clear, joyous sound.
A child! Praise the gods!
T'Thar looked thoughtfully at Thomas.
Do you claim the throne?
Aye, I do, T'Thar,
Thomas said, a smile upon his face. Kaelin spoke for the first time.
It is my inheritance, Thomas. You will have to contest with me for it.
Thomas smiled at Kaelin.
I will not cross swords with you, son of my beloved.
If you seek to be king among us, then you must.
Thomas walked over to Kaelin. There had never been any affection between them, for more than the others. Kaelin had feared Thomas's potential threat to his people and now stood ready to fight if need be. Thomas placed his hand upon Kaelin's shoulder and looked deeply into his eyes.
You are heir. I speak not of being your king.
He stepped away and addressed the council.
I am what you see before you, a being of two heritages. I possess the power of the Valhuru, though I was not born to it, and my mind remembers ages long gone to dust. But I can remember a boy's memories, and can again feel the joy in laughter and a lover's touch.
He looked at the Elf Queen.
I claim only the right to sit beside my queen, with your blessings, as her consort. I will take only what rule she and you give, nothing more. Should you give none, still I will remain at her side.
Then, with firmness, he added,
But I will not stand down from this. Our child shall have a heritage unblemished by a sinister birth.
There was a general murmur of approval, and Thomas faced Aglarana.
If you will take me as husband?
He said in the ancient elven language. Aglarana sat with eyes gleaming. She looked at T'Thar.
I will.
Is there any who denies me the right? Tathar looked around at the other counselors. Seeing no dissension, Tathar said,
It is permitted, my lady.
Abruptly, there was a shout of approval from the gathered elves, and soon others were coming to investigate the unusual display of activity in the council. They, in turn, joined in the celebration, for all knew of the queen's love for the warrior in white and gold, and they judged him a fit consort. Kaelin said,
You are wise in our ways, Thomas. Had you done otherwise, there would have been strife or lingering doubt. I thank you for your prudence.
Thomas took his hand in a firm grip.
It is only just, Kaelin. Your claim is without question. When your queen and I have journeyed to the Blessed Isles, then our child will be your loyal subject.
Aglarana came to Thomas's side, and Martin joined them to say,
Joy in all things.
Thomas embraced his friend, as did the queen.
Kaelin shouted for silence. When the noise had died, he said, It is time for clear speaking. Let all know that what has been fact for years is now openly acknowledged. Thomas is war leader of Elvander, and prince consort to the queen. His words are to be obeyed by all save the queen. I, Kaelin, have spoken.
And I, too, say this is true, echoed Tathar.
Then the council bowed before the queen and her husband-to-be. Martin said,
It is well I shall leave Elvander as happiness returns.
Aglarana said, You are leaving?
I fear I must. There is still a war, and I am still Huntmaster of Crydee. Besides, he said with a grin, I fear young Garrett is growing overly content to rest and partake of your largesse. I must harry him along the trail before he gets fat.
You'll stay for the wedding? Asked Thomas.
As Martin began to apologize, Aglarana said,
The ceremony can be tomorrow.
Martin conceded.
One more day? I will be pleased.
Another shout went up, and Thomas could see Dolgan pushing through the crowd. When the dwarf chief stood before them, he said,
We were not invited to the council, but when we heard the shouts, we came.
Behind him, Thomas and Aglarana could see the other dwarves approaching. Thomas placed his hand upon Dolgan's shoulder.
Old companion, you are welcome. You have come to a celebration.
There is to be a wedding.
Dolgan fixed them both with a knowing smile.
Aye, and high time.
The rider spurred his horse past the lines of Serrani soldiers. He was still discomforted by the sight of so many of them passing to the east, and the recent enemy watched him ride by with guarded expressions as he headed toward Elvander. Lorry pulled in his horse near a large outcropping of rock where a Serrani officer in black and orange armor supervised the passing soldiers. From his officer's plume and insignia, he was a force leader, surrounded by his cadre of strike leaders and patrol leaders. To the force leader, he said,
Where lies the closest ford across the river?
The other officers regarded Lorry with suspicion, but if the force leader felt any surprise at the barbarian's nearly perfect Serrani, he did not show it. He inclined his head back the way his men marched from and said,
A short way from here. Less than an hour's march. Faster on your beast, I'm sure. It is marked by two large trees on either side of a clearing, above a place where the river falls a short way.
Lorry had no difficulty identifying the house colours the man wore, as it was one of the five great families, and said,
Thank you, force leader. Honour to your house, son of the Minwanabi.
The force leader stood erect. He did not know who this rider was, but he was courteous, and that courtesy must be returned.
Honour to your house, stranger.
Lorry rode forward past the dispirited Serrani soldiers plodding along the banks of the river. He found the clearing above the small falls and rode into the water. The river ran swiftly here, but the horse managed to cross without incident. Lorry could feel the spray from the falls as the wind blew it back in his direction. It felt cool and refreshing after the hot ride. He had been in the saddle since before daybreak and would not finish his ride until after night had fallen. By then he would be close enough to Elvander to be intercepted by elven sentries. They would certainly be watching the Serrani withdrawal with interest, and one could guide him to their queen. Lorry had volunteered to carry the message, for it was felt that the messenger would be less likely to encounter trouble if he could speak Serrani. He had been challenged 3 times during his ride, and each time he had explained his way past suspicious Serrani officers. There might be a truce, but there was little trust yet. When he was clear of the river, Lorry dismounted, for his horse was tired. He walked the animal to cool it off. He pulled the saddle from the mount's back and was rubbing him down with a brush carried in his saddlebags when a figure stepped out from among the trees. Lorry was startled, for the figure was not an elf. He was a dark-haired man with grey at the temples, dressed in a brown robe and holding a staff. He approached the minstrel without hurry and seemingly at ease. He stopped a few feet away and leaned on his staff.
"Well met, Lorry of Tirsog."
The man possessed a strange manner, and Lorry did not remember having met him before.
"Do I know you?"
"No, but I have knowledge of you, troubadour."
Lorry edged closer to his saddle, where his sword lay. The man smiled and waved his hand in the air. Abruptly, Lorry was filled with calm, and he stopped moving for his sword. Whoever this man was, he was obviously harmless, he thought.
"What brings you to the Elven Forest, Lorry?"
Without knowing why, Lorry answered, "I bring messages to the Elf Queen."
"What are you to say?"
"That Liam is now heir, and peace has been restored. He invites the elves and the dwarfs to the valley in 3 weeks' time, for there will they seal the peace." The man nodded.
"I see. I am on my way to see the Elf Queen. I will carry word. You must have better things you can do with your time."
Lorry started to protest, but stopped. Why should he travel to Elvander when this man was bound there anyway? It was a waste of time. Lorry nodded. The man chuckled.
"Why don't you rest here for the night? The sound of water is soothing, and there is little chance of rain. Tomorrow return to the prince and tell him that you carried the message to Elvander. You spoke with the queen and Thomas, and they were agreed to the prince's wishes. The dwarves of Stone Mountain will hear also. Then tell Liam that the elves and the dwarves will come. He may rest assured they will come."
Lorry nodded. What the man was saying made a great deal of sense. The stranger turned to leave, then said,
"By the way, I think you'd best not mention our meeting."
Lorry said nothing, but accepted what the stranger said without question. After the man was gone, he felt a great sense of relief that he was on his way back from Elvander and that his message had been received. The ceremony took place in a quiet glade, with Aglarana and Thomas exchanging vows before T'Thar. No one else was there, as was the elven way, while they pledged their love. T'Thar invoked the blessings of the gods and instructed them on their duty, one to the other. When the ceremony was complete, T'Thar said,
"Now return to Elvander, for it is time for feasting and celebration. You have brought joy to your people, my queen and my prince."
They rose from their kneeling positions and embraced. Thomas stepped back and said,
I would have this day remembered, beloved.
He turned and cupped his hands around his mouth.
In the ancient language of the elves, he cried, Belgrosh! Belgrosh! Attend us!
The sound of hooves pounding the earth could be heard. Then a small band of white horses raced into the glade, ran toward them, and reared in salute to the elf queen and her consort. Thomas leaped upon the back of one. The elf steed stood quietly, and Tathar said,
By no other way could you have shown so well that you are now one with us.
Aglarana and Tathar mounted, and they rode back to Elvander. When they came into sight of the tree city, a great shout went up from the assembled elves. The sight of the queen and her prince consort riding the elf steeds was, as Tathar said, a confirmation of Thomas's place in Elvander. The feasting went on for hours, and Thomas observed that the joy he felt was shared by everyone. Aglarana sat next to him, for a second throne had been placed in the council hall, acknowledging Thomas's rank. Every elf who was not keeping watch over the outworlders came to stand before them, pledging loyalty and offering blessings on the union. The dwarves also offered their congratulations and joined in the festivities wholeheartedly, filling the glades of Elvander with their boisterous singing. Long into the night, the celebration wore on. Suddenly, Thomas stiffened. A chilled wind seemed to pass through him. Aglarana gripped his arm, sensing something amiss.
Husband, what is it?
Thomas stared into space.
Something strange. Like the other night. Hopeful, but sad.
Abruptly, there was a shout from the edge of the clearing below Elvander. It cut through the sound of the celebration, but what was being said was unclear. Thomas rose, with Aglarana at his side, and crossed to the edge of the huge platform. Looking down, he could see an elven scout below, clearly out of breath.
What is afoot?
Thomas shouted.
My lord, came the reply. The outworlders, they withdraw.
Thomas was rooted in place. Those simple words struck him like a blow. His mind couldn't comprehend the Serani's leaving after all these years of fighting. He shook off the feeling.
To what ends? Do they marshal?
The scout shook his head.
No, my lord, they are not staging. They move slowly, without alarm. Their soldiers look dispirited. They break camp along every mile of the Cridy and turn east.
The guard's upturned face showed an expression of stunned but joyful understanding. He looked at those nearby, then with a smile said simply,
They are leaving.
A shout of incredible joy went up, and many openly wept, for it seemed that at last the war was ended. Thomas turned and saw tears on the face of his wife. She embraced him, and they stood quietly for a moment. After a time, the new prince consort of Elvander said to Kaelin, who stood nearby,
Send runners to follow, for it may be a trick.
Aglarana said, Do you truly think so, Thomas? He shook his head.
I only wish to make sure, but something inside tells me this is truly the end.
It was the hope of peace with the sadness of defeat mingled together that I felt. She touched his cheek, and he said,
I will send runners to the kingdom camp and inquire of Lord Boric what is happening.
She said,
If it is peace, he will send word.
Thomas looked at her.
True. We shall wait, then.
He studied her face, centuries old, but still filled with the beauty of a woman in her first bloom.
This day will doubly be remembered as a day to celebrate.
Neither Thomas nor Aglarana were surprised when Macris arrived in Elvander, for they had ceased being amazed at the sorcerer after his first visit. Without ceremony, he stepped forward from the trees surrounding the clearing and crossed toward the tree city. The entire court was assembled, including Longbow, when Macris came to stand before the queen and Thomas. He bowed and said,
"Greetings, lady, and to your consort."
"Welcome, Macris the Black," said the queen. "Have you come to unravel the mystery of the Outworlder's withdrawal?" Macris leaned upon his staff and nodded.
"I bring news."
He seemed to consider his words carefully.
"You should know that both the king and the Lord of Crydy are dead. Liam is now heir."
Thomas noticed Martin. The huntmaster's face was drained of blood. His features remained impassive, but it was clear to Thomas that Martin was rocked by the news. Thomas turned toward Macross.
"I knew not the king, but the duke was a fine man. I am sorry for such news."
Macross went over to Martin. Martin watched the sorcerer, for while he had never met him, he knew him by reputation, having been told by Arutha of the meeting upon his island and by Thomas of his intervention during the Surani invasion of Elvanda.
"You, Martin Longbow, are to go at once to Crydy. There you will sail with the princesses Carleen and Anita for Krondor."
Martin was about to speak when Macross raised his hand. Those of the court paused, as if taking a breath. In a near whisper, Macross said,
"At the last, your father spoke your name in love."
Then his hand dropped, and all was as it had been. Martin felt no alarm, but rather a sense of comfort from the sorcerer's words. He knew no one else had been aware of the brief remark. Macross said,
"Now hear more glad tidings. The war is over. Liam and Ichindar meet in 20 days' time to sign a peace treaty."
A cheer went up in the court, and those above shouted the news to those below. Soon all of the elven forests echoed with the sound of rejoicing. Dolgan again entered the council, wiping his eyes.
"What's this? Another celebration without us while I nap? You'll make me think we're no longer welcome."
Thomas laughed.
"Nothing of the kind, Dolgan. Fetch your brethren and have them join our celebration. The war is over."
Dolgan took out his pipe and knocked the dottle from it, kicking the burned-out tobacco over the edge of the platform.
"Finally,"
he said, as he opened his pouch. He turned away, as if intent upon filling his pipe, and Thomas pretended not to notice the wetness upon the dwarven chief's face. Arutha sat upon his father's throne, alone in the great hall. He held the message from his brother, which he had read several times, trying to understand that their father was truly gone. Grief sat heavy upon him. Carleen had taken the news well. She had gone to the quiet garden beside the keep to be alone with her thoughts. Thoughts ran riot through Arutha's mind. He remembered the first time his father had taken him hunting, then another time when he had come back from hunting with Martin Longbow, and how proudly he had listened to his father exclaim over the large buck he had taken. He vaguely recalled the ache when he had learned of his mother's death. But it was a distant thing, dulled by time. The image of his father enraged in the king's palace suddenly came to him, and Arutha let out a slow sigh. "At least," he said to himself, "most of what you had wished has come to pass, father. Roderick is gone and Guy is in disgrace."
"Arutha," said a voice from the other side of the hall.
Arutha looked up. Stepping from the shadows of the doorway came Anita, her satin-slippered feet making no sound as she crossed the stone floor of the hall. Lost in his thoughts, he hadn't noticed her enter. She carried a small lamp,
for evening had cast the hall into deep gloom. The pages were reluctant to disturb you, but I couldn't see you sitting alone in the darkness, she said. Arutha felt pleasure at the sight of her, and relief she had come. A young woman of uncommon sense and tender ways, Anita was the first person Arutha had known to see beneath his surface calm and dry humor. More than those who had known him since boyhood, she understood his moods and could lighten them, knowing the right words to comfort him. Without waiting for him to answer, she said, I have heard the news, Arutha. I am so terribly sorry. Arutha smiled at her. Not yet over your own grief at your father's passing, and you share mine. You are kind. Word of Erland's death had come a week before on a ship from Krondor. Anita shook her head, her soft red hair moving in a rippling wave around her face. Father was very ill for many years. He prepared us well for his death. It was a near certainty when he was put into the dungeon. I knew that when we left Krondor. Still, you show strength. I hope I am able to bear up as well. There is so much to be done. She spoke quietly. I think you will rule wisely, Liam in Rillanon, you in Krondor. I? In Krondor? I've avoided thinking about that. She sat at his side, taking the throne Carleen sat in when at her father's side in court. She reached over and placed her hand upon Arutha's, resting on the arm of the throne. You must. After Liam, you are heir to the crown. The Prince of Krondor is the heir's office. There is no one to rule there but you. Arutha looked uncomfortable. Anita, I have always assumed I would someday become Earl of some minor keep, or perhaps seek a career as an officer in one of the Border Baron's armies. But I had never thought to rule. I am not sure I welcome being Duke of Crydee, let alone Prince of Krondor. Besides, Liam will marry, I am sure. He always caught the girl's eyes, and as king he'll certainly have his pick. When he has a son, the boy can be Prince of Krondor. Anita shook her head firmly. No, Arutha, there is too much work to be done now. The Western realm needs a strong hand, your hand. Another viceroy is not likely to win trust, for each lord will suspect any other who is named. It must be you. Arutha studied the young woman. In the 5 months she had been at Crydee, he had come to care dearly for her, though he had been unable to express his feelings, finding words lacking when they were together. She was each day more a beautiful woman, less a girl. She was still young, which made him uncomfortable. With the war in progress, he had kept his thoughts away from their respective father's plans for a possible marriage, revealed to him that night aboard the Sea Swift. Now, with peace at hand, Arutha was suddenly confronted with that question. Anita, what you say is possibly true, but you also have a claim to the throne. Didn't you say your father's plan for our marriage was designed to bolster your claim to Krondor? She looked at him with large green eyes. That was a plan to foil Guy's ambitions. It was to strengthen your father's or brother's claim to the crown should Roderick die heirless. Now you need not feel bound to those plans. Should I take Krondor, what will you do? Mother and I have other estates. We can live quite well upon the revenues, I am sure. Struggling with emotions within himself, Arutha spoke slowly. I have not had time to weigh this in my mind. When I was last in Krondor, I learned how little I know of cities, and I know less than that of governing. You were raised for such undertakings. I was only a second son. My education is lacking, There are many able men, here and in Krondor, who will advise you. You have a good head for things, Arutha, the ability to see what must be done, and the courage to act. You will do well as Prince of Krondor."
She rose and leaned over to kiss his cheek.
"There is time for you to decide how best to serve your brother, Arutha. Try not to let this new responsibility weigh too heavily upon you."
"I will try. Still, I would feel better knowing you were close by. You and your mother," he added with a rush. She smiled warmly.
"We will be close at hand should you have need of our advice, Arutha. We will likely stay upon our estate in the hills near Krondor, just a few hours' ride from the palace. Krondor is the only home I've known, and Mother has lived nowhere else since she was a girl. Should you wish to see us, you have but to command, and we will happily come to court. And should you wish to find respite from the burdens of office, you will be a welcome guest."
Arutha smiled at the girl. "I suspect I will be visiting with regularity, and I hope I do not wear out my welcome."
"Never, Arutha."
Thomas stood alone on the platform, watching the stars through the branches above. His elven senses informed him someone had come up behind. With a nod, he greeted the sorcerer. "I am but 25 years in this life, Macross, though I bear memories of ages. All my adult life I have been waging war. It seems a dream."
"Let us not turn this dream into a nightmare."
Thomas studied the sorcerer. "What do you mean?" Macross said nothing for a time, and Thomas awaited his words with patience. At last the sorcerer spoke.
"There is this thing which must be done, Thomas, and it has fallen to you to finish this war."
"I like little the tone of your words. I thought you said the war was finished."
"On the day of the meeting between Liam and the Emperor, you must marshal the elves and dwarves to the west of the field. When the monarchs meet in the center of the field, then will there be treachery."
"What treachery?" Thomas's face showed his anger.
"I may say little more, save that when Ichinder and Liam are seated, you must attack the Surani with all your forces. Only this way can Midkemia be saved from utter destruction."
A look of suspicion crossed Thomas's face. "You ask much for one unwilling to give more." Macross stood tall, holding his staff to one side, like a ruler his scepter. His dark eyes narrowed, and his brows met over his hooked nose. His voice stayed soft, but his words were hot with anger. Even Thomas felt something akin to awe in his presence.
"More,"
he said, biting off the word.
"I gave you all, Valharu. You are here by dint of my actions over many years. More of my life than you will know has been given to preparing for your coming. Had I not bested, then befriended Ruag, you would never have survived in the mines of Mac Mordain Cadao. It was I who prepared the armor and sword of Ashen Sugar, leaving them with the hammer of Tholin and my gift to the dragon, so that centuries later you would discover them. It was I who set your feet upon the path, Thomas. Had I not come to aid you, years past, Ilvander would now be ashes. Do you think T'Thar and the other spellweavers of Ilvander were the only ones to work on your behalf? Without my aid over these last 9 years, you would have been destroyed utterly by the dragon's gifts. No mere human could have withstood such ancient and powerful magic without the intervention only I could make. When you were swept along upon your dream quests to the past, it was I who guided you back to the present. I who returned you to sanity.
The sorcerer's voice rose.
It was I who gave you the power to influence Ashen Sugar. You were my tool.
Thomas stepped back before the controlled fury of the sorcerer's words.
No, Thomas. I have not given you much. I have given you everything.
For the first time since donning the armor in Mac Mordane Cadal, Thomas felt fear. In the most basic fiber of his being, he suddenly was aware of how much power the sorcerer possessed, and that should Macris choose, he could brush him aside like a nettlesome insect.
Who are you?
He asked quietly, controlled fear in his voice. Macross's anger vanished. He leaned once again upon his staff, and Thomas's fears fled, and with them all memory of his fears. With a chuckle, Macross said,
I tend to forget myself upon occasion. My apologies.
Then he grew serious once again.
I do not ask this thing from any demand of gratitude. What I have done is done, and you owe me nothing. But know this, both the creature called Ashen Sugar and the boy called Thomas shared an abiding love of this world, each in his own way, incomprehensible to each other as that love was. You possess both aspects of the love of land, the desire of the Valharu to protect and control, and the desire of the Keep Boy to nurture and nourish. But should you fail in this task I set before you, should you stint in resolve when the moment is nigh, then know with dread certainty this world upon which we stand shall be lost, lost beyond recalling. This, on my most holy oath, is the truth.
Then I shall do as you instruct. Macross smiled.
Go then to your wife, Prince Consort of Elvander. But when it is time, marshal your army. I go to Stone Mountain, for Hawthorne and his soldiers will join you. Every sword and warhammer is needed.
Will they know you? Macross gazed at Thomas.
Indeed they will know me, Thomas of Elvander. Never doubt.
I shall gather all the might of Elvander, Macross. A grim note entered his voice. And for all time, we will put an end to this war. Macross waved his staff and vanished. Thomas waited alone for a time, struggling with a newfound fear that this war would last forever. Chapter 14. Betrayal. The armies stood facing one another. Seasoned veterans eyed each other across the open valley floor, not quite ready to feel at ease in the presence of an enemy they had fought for 9 years and longer. Each side was composed of honor companies, representing the nobles of the kingdom and clans of the empire. Each numbered in excess of 1,000 men. The last of the Surani invasion army was now entering the rift, returning home to Keliwan, leaving only the Emperor's honor detachment behind. The kingdom army was still camped at the mouths of the two passes into the valley and would not leave the area until the treaty was finalized. There was still a cautious aspect to the newfound trust. On the kingdom side of the valley, Liam sat astride a white warhorse, awaiting the emperor's arrival.
Nearby, the nobles of the kingdom, their armor cleaned and polished, sat their horses. With them were the leaders of the Free City's militia and a detachment of Natalie's rangers. Trumpets sounded from across the field, and the Empress party could be seen emerging from the rift. Imperial banners fluttered in the breeze as the procession moved to the head of the Serrani contingent. Awaiting the Serrani herald, who was walking across the several hundred yards that separated the opposing monarchs, Prince Liam turned to regard those who sat on horseback nearby. Pug, Colgan, Meacham, and Lorry were accorded their position of honour by dint of their service to the kingdom. Earl Vandross and several other officers who had distinguished themselves were also close by. Next to Liam sat Arutha, astride a chestnut warhorse, who pranced in place out of high spirits. Pug looked around, feeling a giddy sensation at the sight of all the symbols of two mighty nations with whose fates he had been so closely tied. Across the open field he could see the banners of the powerful families of the Empire, all familiar to him. The Kida, the Wahakatukan, the Minwanabi, and the rest.